Today on Maine Calling, the high cost of electricity. Maine and the rest of New England have some of the highest electric rates in the nation. Why? Well, it's not a simple answer. The cost of natural gas is a big part of the reason. So is the fact that New England doesn't have a massive hydropower dam like some states out west. Other factors include the costs of repairing lines and replacing poles after storms, and recent transmission upgrades. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we dig into electric costs. We discuss historic factors, why customers of CMP and Versant saw a rate increase on January 1st, and whether the conversion to renewable energy adds to the bottom line on your bill. Also part of the conversation today, what can be done to keep costs in check as demand grows? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn, and by Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self. MaineHealth.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Do your electric bills seem high? Well, we will ask experts how the electricity prices in Maine are calculated and what's being done to keep them from rising more. Joining me, Bill Harwood, who is public advocate for the state of Maine, Phil Bartlett, chairman of the Maine Public Utilities Commission, or PUC, and Carlisle Tuggy, general counsel for Central Maine Power, or CMP. She's a former Maine PUC commissioner. We invite you to join the conversation. Share your questions about electricity rates in Maine. You can send an email to talk, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us today. And Phil Bartlett, I'm going to start with you. We're going to talk about people's specific bill in just a minute and fluctuations in bills, electric bills. But first, I want to sort of zoom out and look at the big picture. I know that many people recently have moved to Maine from somewhere else, maybe out west, and are really surprised by their electric bill. So if you could very briefly give us a little bit of a history lesson. Why is it that New England electric rates are among the highest in the nation?
Yeah, unfortunately, New England is a high cost region, one of the highest costs in the country. And that's because we historically have not had significant resources here that we can draw on. So for example, if you have a large federally funded hydro dam in your neck of the woods, you're gonna have fairly cheap electricity. If you have a lot of natural gas or coal deposits, then those are places that tend to experience very low electricity prices. In New England, most of our electricity is produced with natural gas, and we don't have any of that here. So we're importing it both from other parts of the country, and particularly in the very cold winter months, we're relying on imported liquefied natural gas, which is very expensive, and we're competing on an international market for that fuel. The good news going forward is that as we transition to renewables, New England is very rich in renewable resources. So it is our hope that as we bring on more wind, solar, and other renewable resources, that over time we will be able to significantly reduce the supply costs for your electricity.
And how big, Phil, of a factor is the fact that, 30 years ago we had quite a few nuclear power plants in New England, and now we only have two?
Yeah, absolutely. We don't have as much of that baseload generation where a substantial amount of the costs have already been incurred. So that certainly is a factor. Nuclear certainly wasn't extraordinarily cheap, but as those resources were retired, we brought on much more volatile priced resources in the form of natural gas. And unfortunately, most of the cost of electricity produced by natural gas is that fluctuation in fuel price. And we've seen, particularly in recent years, a tremendously volatile international market for natural gas.
All right. Well, Bill, I'm going to turn to you as public advocate. You are the person who talks with consumers about their bills. What do you hear from consumers? Are they concerned? Do they believe their bills are too high? And what do you tell them?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jennifer, for having me. We get a steady calls into our office every day with people really concerned about the affordability of electricity. It is a real problem, particularly for low-income people. The extent to which we impose these electricity costs on people struggling with a limited household budget is a real problem. We try what we can to encourage them to make sure that they're using the electricity wisely. One thing we find with many of them is they are paying these competitive electricity providers far more than the standard offer price that's set by Commissioner Bartlett at the PUC. And what we encourage those people is to get off the CEP pricing and get on to standard offer pricing. There's an easy savings for those people who are paying more than standard offer.
All right. And Phil, I'm going to toss it back to you. I know this is very complicated, but you're really good at explaining things clearly. How does the PUC set these prices for the standard offer, which is, if people don't know, the default? If you don't choose something else, the standard offer is what you pay for your electricity. Phil, how is that set?
We do an annual procurement process. So we issue a request for proposals every fall, and competitive suppliers from around the region will give us their best prices. And then we put together sort of a bundle of offerings from those CEPs and come up with a standard offer price for the year. The price is set on a calendar year basis. So it's January 1 through December 31st. So we complete that process usually in November or early December at the very latest, and set the rates for the upcoming year. It is important to recognize that while customers can choose their own competitive provider, they don't have to rely on the standard offer. In fact, in Maine, most people do. I think it's over 90% of residential customers, and most small commercial customers as well rely on the standard offer that we procure every year.
Carlisle, I'm going to turn to you. I think that people may be confused because the news last November is that there was going to be, because you work for Central Maine Power, talk about CMP, there was going to be an adjustment down in their CMP bill, and now you open the paper this year and you find out that as of January 1st, your CMP bill is going to be up 7%. Explain what has happened and why.
No, yeah, that's a great question. So here at CMP, we sort of act as a billing agent for a number of different components of the energy bill. So in addition to what it costs to maintain and build the poles and wires, which are really what you see along the roads leading energy to your home, as a component of that, as it was just referenced by Chairman Bartlett, is the supply of energy, which is set by the market, which does fluctuate and increases and decreases depending on the cost of that commodity, which in our case in New England is gas. And as we know, in recent years, the cost of gas has gone up. And so we see that supply component of the bill go up. And what we know is that's about 45% of the total customer bill. So that has been a big driver of cost. In addition, we've seen impact of more frequent and severe storms. Last year, the company responded to 30 significant storm incidents, which was more than we'd ever seen in any year prior. And that leads to increased cost of recovery. And what we're aiming to do is look at make strategic investments that we hope, if we partner with the folks on this call, as well as stakeholders, will over time see a trajectory of reducing those storm costs and bringing them back into control. But that's a new and changing phenomenon that we really see happening with Mother Nature impacting us.
So how much of that 7% increase is from the supply, the increase in natural gas prices? How much is from responding to storms? And what are other factors?
Yeah, so I think if we look at about a $7 to $8 increase, the storm component of that is about $1. And then we see the supply component making up about 10% of the total bill. I'm sorry, 45% of the total bill. And then we also see other components of the bill. So if you break your bill down, you've got your supply, which is what we've been talking about. We have the distribution, which is the poles and wires. Then we have the transmission, which is really the backbone of the grid, which we share with the region and we pay 8%. And then we have our public policy costs. And we have seen Maine take very aggressive public policy positions and roll out incentive programs for the solar development that you see across the landscape in Maine. And there is a cost associated that is funded by the utility customer. So we see those increases just hitting the customer bills for the first time in 2022, and we're seeing that targeted to forecast to increase until it levels off in 2 to 3 years. And so those are really what's driving the increase. And now, of course, there are good reasons for those public policy programs, but they do have an associated cost. And in there's also low-income programs, which are very important as well.
All right.
So it's a confluence of factors, Jennifer.
Okay, I was just wondering what made up most of the increase. What is most of the increase? And I do want to delve into this solar development because I know this is a bit of this gets political, and I'm going to try to not be political. But I'll turn to you, Bill Harwood. If you could, I know that people who are advocates of solar development say, "Wait a minute." Solar development has more value for all consumers than we are paying into it, and others say it is costing us too much. What is your analysis of what Maine is doing to develop renewable energy and what it's costing tax ratepayers today?
Thanks, Jennifer. Yeah, this has been a very hot political issue and one that we've struggled with. Let me start by saying we all want more renewable energy. We want more wind and solar. We want more batteries. The question isn't the value or the benefits of that. The benefits, let's face it, if we can avoid the kind of storms we faced last winter along our coast, the value is extraordinary. The harder question is, how much should we subsidize this? How big a subsidy do these developers need? And that's really where this net energy billing that CMP has mentioned a minute ago come in. And how big is that subsidy? Our office estimates that that subsidy is growing, and it's almost there, to $220 million a year. That's a lot of money for Maine ratepayers. Again, we want to subsidize it, but we can do less. We just saw a report out of Connecticut in which they procured from a Maine solar farm solar energy for Connecticut ratepayers at less than 14 cents a kilowatt hour, whereas our net energy billing program, we're paying more than 20 cents a kilowatt hour. You have to ask yourself, why are we paying so much more for solar energy here than in other places where it is just as competitive?
All right. And Phil, I want to turn to you. I understand that a cost and benefit analysis that the PUC did last year found the economic benefits of net energy billing outweighed the cost of the program. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, there's no question that there are significant benefits to the net energy billing program. And it's important to recognize the difference between distributed generation resources and then the larger scale wind and solar that is connected to the transmission system. So those would be the really huge projects. So the distributed system, when you're adding resources there, it can help us in a number of ways. One, it can add resilience to the grid. Anytime you're adding new renewables, you're helping put downward pressure on electricity prices in the region. Because solar is often considered behind the meter, think of your rooftop solar, for example, that's kind of reducing your electric use. That has the effect of reducing our share of regional transmission charges because we're using the transmission system less. So there are also significant environmental benefits that you get from distributed resources as well. So it's important to understand that, if Connecticut is procuring, for example, solar energy in Maine, they're doing that at sort of a grid scale level versus the distributed resources, which by their nature are smaller and tend to be more expensive. That's not to say the NEB program is perfect, but that has been sort of capped, and we'll be moving on to, I think, look at other ways to incentivize solar going forward. But there are really tangible benefits by having more of the distributed resources, whether it is solar or batteries or other distributed energy producers. on your system because it can significantly improve resiliency and flexibility and reduce the need to import a lot of electrons from out of state.
So, Phil, if I'm understanding you correctly, yes, Maine is subsidizing the rollout of more and more solar, but our prices may even be higher if we did not have this solar in the system already. It's helping keep prices from going even higher. Would you say that's an accurate reading of what you just said? Analysis?
That's right.
Of what you, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Your prices are lower than they otherwise would be. And it also, quite frankly, can help you to not have to build as much, to build your system as big when you have the distributed resources. So there are very significant savings over time by making the investment.
All right. Well, on the line now is Dan Burgess, who is director of the Governor's Energy Office. Thank you so much for calling in, Dan.
Yeah. Hi, Jennifer. Great to be here.
So as you know, we're talking about the cost of electricity rates. What is the role of your office in trying to keep rates under control?
So the Governor's Energy Office is the primary policy office of the state. Every state has an energy office, and we have the designated energy office here for Maine. And we are focused on in a policy that delivers affordable, reliable, and cleaner energy for Maine ratepayers. As you've heard in the discussion today, New England as a whole is over-reliant on particularly natural gas to produce our electricity, which has caused volatility and in our energy prices. And so we've been focused with your panel here today on ways to reduce those costs. So first and foremost, I think our energy efficiency investments, since 2019, the state has nearly weatherized 12,000 homes, 150,000 new heat pumps, so really helping Maine consumers with energy efficiency. And then we've been focused on diversifying, so getting away from being solely reliant on natural gas to set the marginal price for electricity, about getting more homegrown renewable energy resources here in Maine. And then finally, as we're part of this regional electric grid, it's about how we're working with our partners and other states to ensure that the investments we're making on the transmission system and even those here in Maine are the right ones, and that we're not over-investing during this time of these ever-increasing storms that we've been talking about as well.
Dan, I understand that there is a new plan coming out later this week, the Maine Energy Plan. What does it call for to do to address cost?
So the Maine Energy Plan will be coming out later this week and includes specific strategies and actions to reduce volatility of our energy prices, electricity and fuels. I know this is an electricity focused panel, but we're the most home heating oil reliant state in the country and are experiencing volatility in our home heating systems as well. But looking at specific strategies to do that, really looking at things like beneficial electrification, so reducing the volatility that homeowners are experiencing by, using things like heat pumps and weatherization. But then also what strategies do we need to diversify our energy mix? So looking for more in-state and in-region renewable energy resources. So we're excited to put that plan out later this week and look forward to talking about it more.
Yeah. And Dan, finally, I understand that your office will soon become an agency. What does that mean for consumers?
Yeah, so the governor last week announced that she's proposing to elevate the governor's energy office to a cabinet-level department or agency in the budget that came out last week. So this is a budget-neutral initiative that will allow for really a more integrated, comprehensive, and consistent approach to energy planning and policy in Maine, ensuring that a department, regardless of what the state might look like in the future, that there's a department that's focused on how to ensure a more affordable, resilient, and cleaner energy future for the state. So department will ensure durability and effective long-term planning, working closely with the folks on this panel to move Maine's energy system forward.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for calling in. Dan Burgess, the director of the State Energy Office. We're going to take a quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the price of electricity, what goes into setting rates, and what can be done to keep them from going up. My guests, Phil Bartlett, Maine Public Utilities Commission Chairman, Carlisle Tuggy, Central Maine Power General Counsel, and Bill Harwood, Maine Public Advocate. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to us, a brief email, please. We already have many in. talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. An email here from Tony, and this is a question that I wanted to get into as well. He asks, is Maine's distribution system adequate for the anticipated transition to electric vehicles and the demands of AI technology? And this is something that I know is a question that's being asked around the country, that there is no doubt there is going to be more demand in the very near future. And anybody who's taken Econ 101 knows the rules of supply and demand. So, Phil, as there's more and more demand for electricity, one, Tony's question, which is, can we handle it, you know, sort of can the transmission lines, et cetera, handle that? And maybe that's a question for you, Carly. But the bigger question is, how do we keep price down when there's more demand for it?
Yeah, there's a lot of things in that question. First and foremost, you know, I shared that concern, you know, question of whether our distribution system was going to be up to the challenge of integrating additional both demand and the distributed energy resources that are coming onto the grid. A few years ago, we had did what's called a grid modernization proceeding. We hired experts kind of look at the state of the grid in Maine and where we need to be, and did a gap analysis of what it would sort of take to get there. And we've been using that sort of as a yardstick as we're evaluating the investments that the utilities are proposing in their rate cases. We also, at the request of the legislature, have started doing a regular planning process. So we have every 5 years, we'll be having a proceeding here at the commission, looking at what priorities the utility should be planning to. And that is taking into account the load growth, the additional resources we expect to put on the grid, and so forth. And then the utilities have 18 months to come back with a plan that then kind of comes before us and is available for stakeholders to comment on and to potentially have revised. So the goal here is a couple of things. One is to clearly identify when the load is coming, you know, when that demand is going to increase, when we're going to be putting new resources onto the grid that we need to accommodate. And then two, how do we plan over a longer time horizon to make sure that we have the system ready when we need it? Because Maine, you know, we're a relatively poor state and electric rates are high and we cannot afford to get too far ahead of ourselves. So what I've tried to think about this as being as close to just in time as possible. If we know that the load, you know, demand for electricity is going to increase, say, 20% in 2 years, well, we need to make sure the grid can accommodate that additional 20%. If we know that it's going to be up 100% in 15 years, then we've got to line up the grid to make sure it's ready. So the key is thinking longer term, making investments as they're needed so that the grid is ready, but also not spending too many ratepayer dollars ahead of time, because we don't want to make electricity too unaffordable.
And Carl, I'll quickly ask you this because I do want to focus on price today, but the question did come in about can the distribution system handle this? And what's your answer?
I think this is top of mind for CMP. This is an excellent question, as Chairman Bartlett mentioned, and we are very focused on this. To achieve what the chairman is talking about in terms of just-in-time investment to make sure the grid is ready to adapt, we have seen unprecedented engagement with stakeholders as a result of some legislation that Governor Mills took a leadership role on back in 2022. And the utilities, the public advocate, other consumer groups, as well as environmental groups, are really working and talking right now about how do we need to make these investments at least cost to make sure that Maine is ready for this transition. And this is so, so important. And one other concept here I think it's important to keep in mind as a consumer is, as we shift to more of a beneficial electrification, EV-driven electric grid, your energy wallet becomes almost more relevant than just your electric bill or your heat bill, because you may see some of the costs that were overcoming out of one pocket shifting over to another pocket. So that's a big component of how we think about costs to the consumer as we move forward here. This is top of mind for CMP, and we're very engaged and pleased that we're talking with groups that perhaps in the past we haven't had as much of an open dialogue with.
Jennifer, an email I can here. Disrupt,
yeah, go ahead,
jump
Bill.
In on one thing for Tony that I think it's a great question. There's another aspect of it. That's what we call rate design, which is sending the best price signal to the consumer. And as we see more and more electric vehicles, we need to adjust. Our office is very concerned about how much expensive brand new infrastructure the utilities invest in. Before we do that, we've got to explore everything else. And one is to send a price signal so that when you get home from work on a night like this, a cold January night, and you pull into your garage, you don't immediately plug in your vehicle, because that's the peak dime. That's when electricity is most valuable and we stress the system. So if we can send a price signal to wait and plug in that vehicle at 8 or 9 p.m. after dinner, we can save all of us a lot of money. So rate design is an important piece of this puzzle.
And this is something for the future, not for today.
Oh, no, we're working on this at rate design very much today.
I mean, but that does not happen today. If somebody were to wait to plug in today, it doesn't matter for their bill.
If they had signed up for one of the programs, they could do that.
Okay, so there are already programs where people can be billed based on the time of day that they use the electricity. Okay, terrific. And do they sign up through CMP or Versant or their provider, Carlisle?
Yes, they do. And absolutely, I'm glad we're talking about this. We should have folks who are interested in signing up for time of use rates call us, 800-750-4000. We can work with you on what would be the best fit for you. This is a really important area that can help drive down costs. If we can shift the peak, we can control consumer costs by having them get onto the right rate based on their usage.
Yeah, so I don't think this is well known. Email here from Prudence. As I've spoken with a few people at CMP, I'd like to make two suggestions. Use a lower rate at inconvenient times of the day. And she goes on, but it sounds as though Prudence doesn't know about this and that she's actually talked to people at CMP who don't. So the right phrase to use is that you'd like to sign up for time of use rates.
Absolutely. And our customer service reps can assist you with determining what the best rate would be based on your usage.
Okay. An email here from Bruce. Why don't electric companies buy natural gas on long-term contracts? This way they can avoid supply disruptions like the Russian attack on Ukraine caused. We know demand is not going away, and we know the life expectancy of generating plants. So I have a feeling, Phil, that Bruce's simple question is not as simple as it seems. What is your answer to him?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not. So this starts with the fact that the utilities no longer own the generation assets. So we deregulated in Maine. So CMP, for example, doesn't own any generation in the state or in the region. All of the generators, the natural gas generators, are owned by separate companies. And then when they produce electricity, they bid it into the wholesale market. And that's ultimately what we're buying out of the wholesale market. So there are some incentives for them to have some firm fuel, but not a lot, because if you're a private generator and you contract for some very expensive gas and then you don't use it, you've lost a lot of money, or if the price drops. So there's not a very strong incentive for gas generators to procure the gas longer term, because they're the ones who are taking the risk. They're the ones who will lose the money. It's not like the olden days where the utilities were in charge of everything and could make some of these longer term arrangements. With that said, there are currently, we're evaluating some changes to the regional wholesale markets that could provide some added incentives for those generators to lock in some longer term contracts. But it is, unfortunately, it's a challenge and it's hard to solve, because you don't have the utilities or the states in a position where we could actually contract for that gas. We're leaving it to merchant generators to make those decisions.
We'll go to Walter, who's calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Walter. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I had 2 points. First, I heard talk about natural gas, but I don't think they mentioned that it's more expensive in New England than in the rest of the United States, which has by far the cheapest natural gas in the world, because a lot of it's imported liquid natural gas, LNG, since we don't have the pipeline capacity to meet demand, especially in the winter. Now, LNG is inherently more expensive than the stuff through the pipeline because you have to chill it and then thaw it when it gets off the ship. But it's also an internationally traded commodity like oil, so it responds to prices around the world. And prices in Europe and Asia are much higher than in the United States. So there may be advantages to making it difficult or impossible to build pipelines in New England, but there are also costs. The second thing I'd say is that regarding subsidizing renewable energy, the real problem is that we are currently subsidizing fossil fuels, which makes renewables hard to compete with them. And we're doing it not just through the tax rules that everyone talks about, but because we don't charge people, including me, for the costs that fossil fuels do to the environment through climate change now and literally for centuries to come all over the world. So every time I fill up my car, I'm just paying for the cost of finding the gas, extracting it, distributing it, and refining it. I'm not paying for the cost of the harm it's going to do to my kids and future generations around the world.
So Walter, two big points. I'm going to turn to Bill Harwood for his reaction to your thoughts. Go ahead. Both about liquefied natural gas, Bill, but also about how fossil fuels are subsidized.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We've got a lot of work to do. We do need to promote renewables. We do need to promote wind and solar, but we also need to find our way to wean ourselves off of natural gas. You lay out all of the issues with liquefied natural gas, the international, when Putin invades Ukraine, all of a sudden our electricity prices went through the roof here in Maine. And that is a problem that we have relied too heavily on those. We've looked in the past at possibilities of investing in more natural gas pipeline to be able to import more. It's very expensive to build those pipelines. There's a lot of people who don't want to see those pipelines in their backyards. So I think the end result is we've got to reduce our dependence on fossil fuel. And that's going to be a lot of work because we are a rural state with heavy dependent on transportation. We have the highest incident. More than half our homes use home heating fuel, all of which has got to be reduced. And we got to find a smart way and a cost-effective way to promote electric vehicles and heat pumps.
All right, Walter, thanks for your call. An email here from Paula. Please address the fact that CMP and other companies operate for profit. It seems to me that public utilities should not be run by private for-profit companies. Private nonprofits or public entities could run utilities and put profits back into infrastructure and services versus big salaries and shareholder profits. Carlisle, I know you did not choose the system. You're an employee of CMP, but can you defend the system as it is?
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean, we are a regulated entity. So in terms of our ability to earn money, we have to act prudently, appropriately. We don't set our rates. So we propose what we think the rates should be. That's scrutinized and heavily vetted by the Office of the Public Advocate and any and all stakeholders through that very public, robust process. And then we turn around and make the investments that we're authorized to make. In terms of our ability to earn a return, we have a set return that we are entitled to earn if we make prudent decisions about the management of the business. Very much appreciate the caller's perspective, but as a utility, we are a regulated entity, so we are engaged in a public process to assure that we act appropriately under the law. And I don't know if either of my colleagues here who are deeply involved with the rate making process can address additional points, but as CMP, I think folks have heard a lot from us in the past several years, and we're working very hard on doing what we say we're going to do and really trying to build trust with our customers and do everything we can to leverage federal dollars to reduce costs and just continue to build trust in the state.
And a related question I'll send to you, Phil, an email here from Rick. How does the PUC evaluate rate increase requests from the utilities? What is to prevent, say, CMP from requesting a 15% increase, knowing it will be reduced by the PUC to the 10% increase they really want?
So we have a robust process that includes a number of stakeholders. You know, the public advocate is one, but we usually have a number of interveners, folks that come in and participate in that proceeding. We do a real soup to nuts review. We ask extensive data requests. We look behind every number. We look at the types of investments that are being made to determine whether we think they are sound and in the public interest. So we are literally reviewing everything and routinely end up disallowing millions of dollars in recovery for a variety of reasons. Another important thing that we've been doing in recent years is setting performance standards as part of these rate cases. So, for example, in CMP's last rate case, they came in proposing a number of improvements in reliability, a lot of investments they wanted to make that they said would significantly improve reliability. So we said, okay, if we're going to improve these investments, we're going to expect you to meet higher reliability standards than you do today. And so we start ramping up the reliability standards over time as those investments are brought online, both from a system-wide perspective, but we also drill down on specific circuits, particular areas where they were making the investments, where we're going to measure the improvements. And if the improvements don't show up, if we're not seeing the benefits that are promised, there will be penalties. And some of the money will be sort of clawed back and returned to ratepayers. So part of our review is, one, sort of digging really deep into the numbers and making sure that every request is appropriate. But secondly, we're increasingly adding performance metrics to say, look, if you're going to, you know, you have to meet certain requirements and certain standards in order to earn your full return. And if not, we're going to give a refund to ratepayers.
All right. Well, we do need to take another quick break. We're talking about electric rates. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, talking about electricity prices in Maine. Joining me, Carlisle Tuggy with CMP, Public Advocate Bill Harwood, and Phil Bartlett with the PUC. I believe the lines are full, but you can give us a try, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email at talk@mainepublic.org or post to Facebook or Instagram. I have a question here from Carl, an email. The Hydro-Quebec connection through Maine to Massachusetts will deliver 1,200 megawatts of power. That approaches Maine's entire natural gas-powered electrical generation supply. I'm going to edit this as I go first time. Why didn't Maine sign up for a portion of the Hydro-Quebec power? The one transmission line could have been designed to transmit more than 1,200 megawatts. Bill, I know that... Carl is talking specifically about the new transmission line that's going to Massachusetts. But I also know that former Governor Paul LePage really wanted to enter into an agreement with Hydro-Quebec. What's your response to Carl, and what are your thoughts about buying more power from Hydro-Quebec?
I think we should certainly be open to it. There is an opportunity for importing more renewable hydroelectric energy from Quebec, and we should certainly be studying that and open to it. When this, my predecessor, was engaged in these discussions with the current Hydro-Quebec transmission line, I think it was very appealing, the idea that the Massachusetts ratepayers would pay for the line, and therefore Maine didn't have to step up. Of course, the downside of that, as the caller said, is that that energy is heading for Massachusetts consumers, not Maine consumers. So it's a trade-off, but the line is there, and it will continue to provide benefits to all of New England.
Phil.
Yeah, I would just note that because Maine is part of a regional system, that when any one state procures additional resources or builds a new resource, we all get the benefit of that, because those electrons are coming in, they're going into the wholesale market, and they're affecting both the price and reliability of electricity here. So that line, even though Massachusetts is paying for it, provides significant price suppression, particularly up in Maine, because the landing point is in Maine. Those electrons are flowing into Maine. Relatively few of those electrons would actually make it to Massachusetts. Most of them will be consumed right here. The key is getting the electricity into the grid. So regardless of who is funding it, we all benefit from both the downward pressure that that is putting on prices and the reliability and economic benefits that can come from it.
And Carlisle, when is the line expected to be completed?
By the end of the year, we're targeting. And just to build on what the other spokespeople have said here, it's just really about price suppression and reducing that market price. When we talked about the components of the consumer's bill, the supply component of the bill can be reduced to the extent that we bring in affordable, clean baseload, such as the hydro energy that's coming in through this line.
That All will right. come in. We'll go to Susan calling from Newcastle. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. My question briefly, my husband and I had participated in the solar bank credits. And when we sold our building and were looking to use those credits, we were basically told that those credits are in the CMP bank and CMP gets to tell you whether you get to keep that or utilize it. And I just thought, you know, that doesn't make sense to me. Why is it in CMP's bank and not mine? Thank you.
Carlisle?
Well, I'm just trying to follow the question regarding the banked credits. So if you're having an issue with, from a consumer protection related, consumer perspective related to your net energy billing bank, I think you need to call our customer service office or the EPA's office.
I called CMP. I called the people that were banking it. I also called the PUC, and I was told by a person who talked to me at the PUC that when the legislation was written, they didn't specify where those would go. And so I'm just curious, have other people brought this up? And, you know, that's a cost. That's losing money when you're trying to save money. So I'm just wondering if anyone has any information about that.
And the only other thing I would say, Jennifer, is that to the extent this is an issue between the consumer and their solar provider, in terms of how those banked credits get applied to the individual customers, is really related to that relationship, and CMP is not in the middle of that, if that makes sense.
You know, I'm going to unfortunately kind of just leave this. And Susan, I know that's not satisfying to you, but we have so many calls and so little time. I'm going to move on. And I hope that you're able to work this out between the PUC and CMP. I'm going to go to Teddy, who's calling from Orland. Hi, Teddy. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. It sounds like we have a scarcity problem of energy since we don't have natural gas. And I just hope that these two things could enter the conversation, one being the amount of existent dams with hydroelectric power that aren't generating for whatever reason strikes me as odd. I know in Bucksport and Orland we have a few. And then the pulpwood market has been in the dumpster for a long time, and other states are buying our biomass to make power, but we don't do much of that, and it's just something I'd like to see talked about. Thank you.
Bill, I'll throw to you with this.
Yeah, the pulpwood and the biomass has been a challenge. We've tried to subsidize that from time to time. It's a fairly expensive way to generate electricity. It hasn't proved to be particularly cost effective. So I think that that's one that we'll continue to look at, but not one that looks like it's a promising for meeting future energy needs.
All right, Teddy, thank you for your call. An email here from Lindy. Why does the cost of storm damage always fall on consumers? Storm damage is part of the cost of doing business. And only after the ability to cover costs by the utility have been exhausted should consumers then be hit up to start paying. It seems like it's the other way around now. Carlisle.
Well, and that's a good question. So in terms of how our base rates are set, there is a component included that is related to what it will cost to recover from a storm. However, I mean, part of running the system is storm response. And so part of that ROE that we talked about earlier and that revenue requirement, it includes what it takes to recover from a storm. And so, the company doesn't pay for that without getting full recovery from the commission, and we get scrutinized and we get reviewed to make sure that we've invested appropriately and that we've acted appropriately. but we are entitled to get recovery for those costs. We don't earn on the cost to recover from a storm, so we don't make a profit on the cost to recover from a storm. What we do is we get recovery for the costs associated with executing on the storm effort.
And Phil, is there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, just note that I think we try to strike a balance because you could, there are two ways you could do this. You could say, look, we're going to look at what are the costs of the average storms and average years, and we're going to put that into rates. And then the utility, you know, your customers pay that rate, the utilities just have to fix everything. Or you could have another way, which is most of the storm costs are allocated separately, and then you have these the additional charges that come up from time to time. We've tried to strike a balance to have some of the cost in embedded in rates, but then for these more extreme, more expensive storms, separate those out. And the reason we do that is because if we had a really bad year with a ton of storms and the utility were to come in for a rate case and we embedded all of the costs of those storm response into rates, then the next year there were no storms, customers would be way overpaying. So I know it's frustrating when you have these additional storm charges that get added onto your rates from time to time, but we believe it is the cheapest way to fund the storm response as opposed to trying to come up with a rate that would cover that, because you'd end up in many years way overpaying the utility rather than paying just what you need to actually fix the system.
All right,
and
I think
this is really an important area. If I can just add one more thing, we've seen these storm costs for the utilities go from about $20 million a year to about $200 million. This is an extraordinary over a very short period of time. And while we've got to get the pricing right, we've also got to get after the utilities to do a better job of hardening their system and protecting their system. We just can't afford $200 million a year of cleaning up the mess. We really need to get ahead of it and prevent some of the mess.
And I just want to add that Bill is right. And we don't want to be having to spend that kind of money to recover from the severe storms, which is why we are working with stakeholders to think about how do we make strategic investments so that our grid is more resilient and more reliable during those storms that we know are going to come with increasing severity and frequency. And
so Carla, what do you mean by working with stakeholders? Who are stakeholders and who's going to, go ahead.
So what the governor did in this legislation she got passed back in 2022 was she directed the utilities to work with stakeholders like environmental groups, consumer advocates, nonprofit organizations, communities, industrial consumers, municipalities to get together. And we've been meeting regularly about how do we address the climate that we're facing in these change storms. And then the idea is that when CMP comes forward with an investment plan of any kind, it would do so with the full visibility and transparency of the folks that care about this, including what the caller asked about, which is the cost of these storms. Because Bill is right, we are seeing exponential increase and we want to get that under control. And we think we need to do that through strategic targeted investment that involves everybody at the table.
It sounds as though it's all in the planning phase right now, in the talking phase. Is anything happening today on the ground to harden the grid? Because here we are in January, and this is when the big storms were last year.
Well, I'm really excited you asked about that, Jennifer, because I do want to just highlight a couple of things we just did this past year that really were, they came out of our last process with this commission, with this chairman, with this Office of the Public Advocate, where we've seen major investments that are going to improve reliability and resiliency. Like, we just put into service Section 80. So we energized our largest grid reliability project, newly rebuilt 22 miles of transmission. It replaces wooden transmission with steel transmission, which is going to be much more resilient during storm. Folks that live down in Biddeford may be familiar with the Biddeford pump station that we just made a big investment in. This is going to allow us to have two electrical lines that when there's a storm outage, we'll be able to continue to run power through there. Fiber cable deployment, also big, that just came out of our last rate case that was supported. And then there's some Augusta area resiliency that we've been working on. So these are examples of the types of investment we're talking about that are aimed at reducing those costs when we continue to see those storms come online.
Yeah, and thank you for that summary. We just have a few seconds left, and I wanted to have time to sort of just give some advice to consumers. We've already heard you, Carly, say that you could sign up for time of use rates and find ways to save on your energy bill this way. Bill, we've heard you say sign up for standard offer. Phil, 5 or 10 seconds, do you have anything to add to that?
Go to mainelectrichelp.com if you're struggling to pay a utility bill. We have a lot of information there about programs that are available that can help.
All right, mainelectrichelp.com. And that is going to be it. Thank you all for being here. Phil Bartlett, chairman of Maine's PUC, Bill Harwood, Maine's public advocate until the end of the month, wishing you well on your retirement, and Carlisle Tuggy, general counsel for CMP. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.